Thanks for joining us tonight. We have full phone lines now. When you hear somebody leave us, 239-1070 is the telephone number. I'm Kevin Lee, along with Donald Davidson. And Donald, on the way in tonight, was listening to Trackside. And that's where we'll start, with Charles Learson. I suspected there would be a few things that you disagreed with.
You didn't hear
the entire interview because we were preempted for a couple of weather delays and you're walking up the elevator. But point, counterpoint, Mr. Learson had his opportunity. Correct a few things as you see them.
Well, actually, there's quite a few publications out there this month that have greatly disappointed me. And I guess I'll just keep on going and get out the shovel and just, try to clear the decks. And maybe next year we can come back and it won't be such, all of these anniversaries and so on and so forth won't stir up stuff. But anyway, there's a couple of points, and then I think we'll move on to something else. I think I've mentioned a couple of times, but there are times when I wish I could stand on top of Mount Everest with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway sound system for just a few minutes and get across a couple of points. There's a number of points, but on Ralph Mulford blew a number of tires. And I don't know if this was brought out in the part of the conversation that you have, but Ray Haroon made four stops. There's a version going out that wasn't discussed tonight that says that he made one stop and changed one tire. Well, that's baloney. He's had to stop at least twice because he had a relief driver who got in and then got out again. So from the time, Haroon apparently made four stops and changed four tires. It looks like the right rear was changed three times. That's not clear. Mulford stopped 11 times, it appears, and changed 14 tires. More importantly, he blew at least two. Those are reported at the time. And Haroon actually had figured out some, maybe as much as a year in advance, or certainly in the early part of May of 1911, he did his own tire testing. There's a version that Haroon went to Firestone the night before the race and said, what speed should I run tomorrow to get the best the best mileage out of the tires? And he was told 75 miles an hour. 75 miles an hour is the correct speed. The rest of it is absolute baloney. I don't even know if Firestone had a racing division, and the company was only a couple of years old. It's been recorded. It's in a book that Al Blemker published, put out in 1961, just 50 years ago. I talked to Haroon, Mr. Haroon, and he told me a lot of this stuff. He had figured, in fact, I think they figured out pretty much during the 1910 Wheeler-Schebler Trophy that if he ran 75 miles an hour, he could double the tire wear over doing 80 miles an hour. If you read Al Blemker's book, there's quite a bit of a conversation in there that he had with Haroon talking about the fact that you could run, 82, 85 or whatever it was, and you'd blow tires. So if you ran at 75, you could run for a length of time and then you'd come in and then just make the change. So anyway, in the newspapers the following day, I'm not sure about that night, but certainly the following day, and in a magazines that came out the next week, it's recorded that Mulford blew at least two tires, and at least one was going into turn one. On into the race, he blows a tire going into turn one, and he makes a lap almost the entire 2.5 miles, so figure maybe 2.25 miles or something, and he does the lap, on the rim, on bricks and mortar. When he comes in, they don't have detachable wheels. They actually change the tires then. And it is reported that when he came in, it was necessary for the mechanics to hammer out the rim before they could change the tire. So all this time, Haroon's still going around at 75 miles an hour. There is also that point's not brought out in the book. He does say something about the fact that he encountered problems on one of his stops. But with all of the detail that's in the book, why wouldn't he describe that one detail, which is recorded? not on Wikipedia, in the publications at the time. And then the other thing, too, is that he makes an issue out of Mulford trying to get back at the officials the following year by spending a lot of time to finish in the final position. He said it's fifth. It's actually tenth. The story was that prize money was paid to the first 10 finishers. Actually, in 1912, they extended it to 12 finishers. And you had to complete the distance. And this was a rule in AAA championship racing for many years, that they would try to get as many cars as reasonable, complete the distance, so the race would continue to go. So in 1912, Mulford had been the second fastest qualifier, not with a Lozier now, but with a Knox, and he'd had encountered some difficulties along the way. And one by one, the cars were coming in to claim 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th, and then finally got to the point where Howdy Wilcox in a national finished 9th, and there's one car still running around, and it was Mulford. So he came in and said, look, my crew have signaled that I'm the only other person still running. Why don't you flag me off and give me 10th place? And they said, well, the rules state that you have to go the distance in order to claim the prize money. There's a 10th, an 11th, and a 12th place position still waiting to be won. So he said, okay, well, he talked to the crew and said, why don't we forget the whole thing? And they said, 10th place pays $1,200. All we have to do is to keep running and we can get it. And so he said to the officials, and when he said everybody was mad, most people had laughed by this time, because this is a considerable time after De Palma had broken down and tried to push home, and all of the other finishers had come in. So everybody's going home now. It's late afternoon, early evening. And so Mulford apparently went out, took a few laps. He came in and he said, look, I've asked my crew if they'll soften up the shock absorbers and make a few other adjustments. So we're going to take a short break here, and we haven't eaten since early this morning. We're hungry. So somebody apparently went out and bought in a hamper of food. There's one version out there that said that he parked the car and went to a hot dog stand while the crowd roared in the aisles. Well, there was no crowd to roar in the aisles. They'd already gone home. There was no such thing as a hot dog, I don't think, in 1912. But anyway, the point is that somebody brought a hamper of food in, and they took some chicken and sandwiches. And then finally, Mulford gets up on the car, and the riding mechanic, Billy Chandler, who rode with him the year before in the Lozier when they finished second, and off they went. And they didn't run 30 miles an hour. But they did run at a fairly leisurely pace, and they did complete the full 500 miles. And the time was 8 hours and 53 minutes, an average of 56.29 miles an hour, which is the longest lapse time to go 500 miles, slowest average speed. Was that to get back at the officials? No, there was just no sense to go any faster than that. I do have this other theory. All this business about Mulford taking an extra lap and coming in and finding that Haroon was already there is absolute baloney. All this business about we was robbed is all baloney. I really believe that it wasn't until years and years later, because I've been telling people a lot this month, the first Indianapolis 500-mile race, was just a long race for a huge purse. They didn't know that it was going to become such an iconic event. And I think the thing was over. They took the money and they went to the next race. And he was very happy to finish second. In fact, there is a news story that I think it's in the Indianapolis Star on June the 4th or June the 5th of 1911. 1911. And it's a Detroit Dateline. And Mulford has driven the Lozier back up to Detroit. And he's saying what a fine race it was. And he congratulates Ray Haroon and Cyrus Patchkey on the great victory for Marmon, that of the 40 starters, that there was no other combination that could come close to them, which doesn't sound like somebody that's very upset, because a few days later. So I think that maybe over the years, as the 500, became established, and it is 10 years old and 20, and then you get into the 40s and 50s, that probably it would come up from time to time. Was he on the speaker circuit and pounding the table? No. People asked him about it, and he said, well, I think I probably won. But I don't know that really occurred to him for probably a number of years. Just a theory.
Okay.
You know, maybe I can get a book deal sometime. It's been a very...
You've had a book deal.
Well, I did, but yeah, I know. It wasn't quite as good as this one. But anyway, it's been a problem over the years that the same stories keep getting rehashed and people put their own spin on it. There's a local publication that has got an even more inaccurate stuff in, and but you won't have to worry about losing your money on that one because it's free. So anyway, it's been difficult to try and deal with all this stuff, and you know, can we prove some of it? No, but there's some theories that I've been trying to put forth for a few years that nobody seems to want to listen to except the dear listeners of this program. So anyway. You've all made your deals, you know, you can get your checks and carry on to the next issue, and there are those of us that will be left here shoveling the stable. Thank you very much.
I think people enjoyed hearing that from you. I always hear people, I want more opinions from Donald. I want Donald to tell us what he really thinks.
Well, one of these days.
You just told us what you really thought, so that's good. If you just joined into this program or listening to the podcast and you wonder what we're talking about, this is a conversation from the previous hour on Trackside, an interview with the author Charles Learson, which is also available on the podcast at 1070thefan.com. All right, to the phones we go. 239-1070 is the number. We start with Brad in Peru.
Hello, Brad.
Hi, Donald. Good talking to you again.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could profile Graham Hill. You've spoke about him a few times this month, but really haven't given a profile on him. So I was wondering if you could profile Graham Hill tonight.
All right. Well, Graham Hill's forte was Grand Prix racing. He did win the 1966 Indianapolis 500. Was he one of the 33 greatest drivers at Indianapolis? No. Was he one of the 33 greatest drivers ever? Yes, I know. Was he one of the 33 greatest drivers to come to Indianapolis? Well, very likely. But I'll do a little bit of an editorial on what I've learned from other drivers. As far as the record is concerned, I mean, he was a mechanic for Lotus. I think he was at Le Mans, like in 55 and 56, I think, or if not 55, certainly 56, he was a mechanic for Lotus. And he worked, he got his driver's license very late in life. I think he was like 25 or something before he even got a driver's license. So he was a little late to get started in racing. It's not like it is now where, you know, you can start racing quarter midgets when you're four and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, he drove sports cars and then was part of the Lotus program very early on, as I say, as a mechanic, and then moved into drives when Lotus was just really in its infancy. But he had most of his success with BRM. He won the world championship. Well, actually, he won the world championship in 62 for BRM and then 68 for Lotus. And I don't recall how many Grand Prix he had. He often was second and third. I mean, there was a couple of times when he had an opportunity to be the world champion, only to lose in the final race on points. As far as Indianapolis is concerned, he came here in 1963 with Mickey Thompson and took the rookie test. Wasn't very comfortable with either the team or the car, or maybe both, and it was necessary, as with the other drivers, to go back and forth across the Atlantic several times during that month. And I think that fairly early in the month, he went back to an event in England. It wasn't a Grand Prix, but it was a major race meet at Silverstone. I think it was Silverstone or Goodwood or somewhere like that. And he elected not to come back. So the next time he appeared, that was 63. The next time he appeared was 1966. And he came in as a last-minute sub for Walter Hanscom, who was going to drive one of the John Meekham cars, and Hanscom was fatally injured in an accident at Le Mans, during the 24 Hours weekend. This was in April when there was a special test, and it was raining, and he aquaplaned and had an accident in which he perished. So, actually, Walt Hanscom was going to drive the number 24 Red Bull special, and the entry right before this accident happened, right before the program went to press, so they actually pulled the driver's name. So if you get the 1966 program, Graham Hill's name is not in there. It's just got a blank for where the driver is, because they didn't know that who was going to be yet. They just pulled Walt Hanskin's name. So anyway, he came in. I think probably it was about, it was be like at the late, well, let's see, because that accident, I think, was April the 23rd or 24th, I think. And so it'd be about May 1st before he even knew he was coming. And then so he shows up, and there was a, it started, I think, on the, I think he started 15th, I believe. And there was an accident at the start involving a number of cars, the only injury being Foyt, who cut his thumb when he was climbing over the fence. But several cars were able to avoid everything, and Graham Hill managed to weave his way through. So the race wore on. The attrition rate was very high. They restarted with 22 cars. 11 were taken out that first lap accident. They stopped the race, and as they say, nobody was injured other than Foyt's thumb. And the attrition rate kept going, and then late in the race, Jackie Stewart, his teammate, was leading, and Jackie had a mechanical problem late in the race. Actually, the oil pressure was dropping. He turned off the engine rather than, you know, instead of keep running until it blew up, he decided that he would stop, and then so Hill sailed by and won the race. And then he came back the next year and had great difficulty in qualifying for the race. He was now with the Lotus team and was Jim Clark's teammate. They were sponsored by STP, and they had a devil of a time getting in, and then they were the second and third cars out. So Graham Hill was 32nd, and Jim Clark, in what turned out to be his last 500, was 31st. The next year, they came back, and they had the wedge turbines, and Hill started in the middle of the front row. Joe Leonard was on the pole, and Hill ran fourth for a good chunk of the race, and then a suspension broke as he was going through turn two on his 120th lap. So I think it shows us 119 laps, and then he was out. In 69, he was back as a sort of a teammate to Mario Andretti and Jochen Rindt. And when you see this on paper, you thought, this is the front row. Lotus, four-wheel drive, turbocharged Fords, Mario Andretti, Graham Hill, Jochen Rindt. What were their finishes? There weren't any because none of them started. Mario just destroyed his in a practice accident, and they withdrew the other two. So that was Graham Hill's last start as a driver. He did come here as a commentator for ABC. And then he continued on. The last couple of years, he was having a bit of a struggle in Formula One and really starting at the back. But he didn't want to give up. And then finally, on the eve of the British Grand Prix in 1975, he announced that he was retiring, and he had his own team by that time. And a young driver by the name of Tony Bryce was his star. And that was July of 75. And then right around Thanksgiving time, both Hill and Tony Bryce went down in a private plane crash. I think there was like four of them coming back from France, and they tried to land near Hill's home in Mill Hill in a fog at the end of November, and they went down, and they were all fatally injured. But about Hill, just a couple of observations. We've got a couple more minutes to make a couple of observations, or do we need to break
schedule.
And come back? Or?
We needed to break 10 minutes ago. So
I'm sorry. Okay, well, I did my diatribe at the beginning of the show for whatever that was worth. But anyway, Hill, I always just felt of him because he didn't look like he really wanted to make the effort to be a driver, you know? And so I heard a comment actually from both Jackie Stewart and Dan Gurney, both made this observation, in fact, at different times. And I asked them both about it because I thought I'd misunderstood. And I think it was Jackie that said something like that what Graham lacked in natural skills, he made up for in tenacity. And I thought it was the other way around. I thought that this was a naturally gifted driver who was able to do it with ease because he didn't look like the kind of person that would just be a terrier, a relentless
like
fighter.
There are athletes like that don't look like they're trying that hard. They do it naturally, but they are.
Well, Jackie Stewart and Dan Gurney are among those that said, "Oh no, he was a workman, and he worked very hard at it. That he had a great deal of inner passion to succeed. And the final one was that he always seemed so calm. And Dennis Jenkinson, a great British journalist, was with motorsport for decades. And he wrote in one of his books, he said that he remembered that he would watch Graham Hill and how he seemed to be so calm all the time. And he said, you know, he kept reminding me of somebody. And he said, I remember being at Le Mans one year, and when Lotus was making pit stops, and they had like 1,100cc cars, he said a lot of the cars would come in at Le Mans, and the mechanics would pour over each other. They'd be tripping over each other and spilling the fuel and everything, trying to do it quickly. And he said, I noticed that Lotus had this one fellow whose job was to do the refueling, and everybody else was bumping into each other, and he would just stand there and very carefully pour the fuel into the tank, and he would be the first one done. And he said, I had my notes, and I went back and looked up from Le Mans from, like, you know, 10 years before, and he said, it was Graham Hill. And he said that Hill had actually gone about it very methodically and thought, how long is this going to take? And I'll just time myself. And he would look at his stopwatch while he was doing it, while everybody was trying to rush and do it as quickly as they could and just banging into each other.
Okay. Thank you for the call, Brad. More questions for Donald coming up on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with 1070 The Fan.
Donald Davidson, celebrating 40 years as the host of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice. On 1070 The Fan.
Well, it looks like tonight is going to be a podcast edition of the program. The only way you might be hearing us right now is on 1070thefan.com. So those of you streaming nationwide can hear us. We've got severe weather here in Indianapolis, and 93 WIBC covers that. I don't know why I bother saying that, because you're not hearing us live in Indianapolis. And if you're listening in Racine or in Los Angeles or Des Moines, you're not really worried about the weather here, but the entire show will be on the podcast. Matt will help me remind that when we get back on the air, and we can tell people of that. But we continue, nonetheless, at 239-1070. And with us next in Columbia is John. Columbia, Missouri?
Columbia Station.
Columbia Station. South Carolina?
No,
where's
Ohio.
Columbia Station?
Oh, Columbia Station, Ohio. Okay.
Okay.
Hi, Donald.
How are you, sir?
Fine, thank you. I've been listening all month. It's been a great series of both questions and responses.
Thank you.
I caught the end of the Learson interview, and I thought, boy, if Donald's listening to this, he's cringing.
Well, that's actually, Kevin and Matt Hicks, the producer, they were trying to steer me out of the room and preoccupy me so I wouldn't hear it. I listened part of it in the car on the way down. And at one point, Matt Hicks was saying, now, Donald. Oh, dear. But anyway, thank you for the consideration. It's not always easy, but that's okay. I'm fine now. I wasn't fine a few minutes ago, but I'm okay now.
Okay. Well, in preparation for the 500, my wife and I are going to watch To Please a Lady.
Oh, yeah.
From 1950, which I'm sure you're familiar
with. Oh, yes.
And, I mean, there's a fair number of Indianapolis personalities in there, and I thought you might talk about that movie just a little
bit. Sure, yeah.
And also, once again, in anticipation of the 500, we're having some recipes out of the Kara cookbook.
Oh, yes.
Gasoline favorites that they issued back in 83.
I remember that.
And one of the recipe sources frequently mentioned is Novella Morales. And I'm guessing that might be Alex Morales' wife or mother or something like that. So I thought you might be able to talk a little bit about Alex Morales, the car owner.
Okay. Well, I'll do that one first. There were five Morales brothers. Alex was the main one. The only one I knew was Gil, and I think it was five brothers. And a couple of them, at least, went back in racing to the 1930s. and they owned a series of sprint cars that were called the Tamale Wagon because they had they were in the Mexican food business. I think they had a restaurant or restaurants, and then there was a food line. There was Alex Foods, Alex Excellent Foods, and it was X and then Lent Excellent Foods. Gil Morales was on Parnelli Jones' team in the 1960s when I first showed up. In fact, he told me a lot of stuff. He talked about Ray Pixley, and he was the first person that told me that if they had left, when Bob Swanson relieved Ralph Hepburn in 1937 and then got out so Hepburn could finish the race and finish 2.16 seconds behind Wilbur Shaw, Gil Morales, I remember being one of several people that told me in 64, they said if they'd left Bob Swanson in the car, he could have won the race. So anyway, the thing is, he talked a lot about Legion Ascot Speedway. And I think Alex must have been the eldest brother, or at least he was the one that had the food company. And then they came into the 500. And let's see, the first one they did was Jimmy Carruthers in 75. And then the best finish they had was Pancho was third in 82. I think they went from 75, I haven't thought about this in a while, they went from 75 until 75 until 83. Seventh with Pancho in 83, I think, was the last one. And it was like third in 82. Mike Mosley drove for them in 78, and I'm jumping around all over the place here. They had Vukovic in 76, and then actually Vuk started out in 77, but they had Lightnings, and he wasn't comfortable with the car, so he got out of it, and Foyt gave him a car, and so Vukovic drove for Foyt in 77. So Bobby Olivero was the only fellow in the 500 with a Morales car. Then 78, Olivero was struggling in practice, and on the last qualifying day, this was amazing. The Sunday morning practice, final qualifying day, a beautiful day, and Bobby Olivero had kind of got stuck through the whole month, and Mike Mosley stepped into the car, and he went out, and ran the slow first lap, and I think he ran like maybe five or six laps, and came in, and said, put it in the qualifying line. And I think that when it was noon, I think he might even have been the first off the line, if not one of the first, and he qualified. And that was just, you know, typical amazing Mike Mosley from time to time, that I think from the time he stepped into the car until he had actually come in having qualified, I think was like maybe 12 laps total, 11 or 12 laps total. And so anyway, then Pancho Carter was the driver in let's see, 80 81. He was 6th in 80, dropped out in 81, 3rd in 82, and 7th in 83. And then I think that was the end for the Morales brothers as far as Indianapolis Motor Speedway was concerned. I don't know if I did a terribly good report on the Alex Morales, but again, I'll just go back and say that the Tamale Wagon was at the Ascot Park for years in CRA. All right, to please a lady, very quickly, the main points I would say, it's a pretty decent film, a little corny in places, but it's pretty decent, and the scenes that I think of, you asked about the other people that appeared in it, I'll do two things here, and I'll wind up with that part. There is a part when Clark Gable has decided that he's going to sell the midget and then buy a championship car. And so he comes into this garage, and that's where he meets the Will Gear character and purchases a car that's actually was the Don Lee special that ran at Indianapolis in 48 and 49 with Mack Hellings. Now, I'm going to back up a little bit. When Clark Gable came to the track to make the film, and which was at least his third trip to the Speedway, but he was going to be staying a little bit longer. Tony Holman and Wilbur Shaw had him come in, and although he was Tony Holman's guest, and I'm going off another little bit of a tangent here, I believe that probably the reason that he got involved back here, Clark Gable, was through Wilbur Shaw, because he used to go to the races in the 30s, and Wilbur Shaw won and would win the Trophy Dash and the features at the Legion Ascot Speedway that I was talking about earlier with the Morales brothers. And Wilbur Shaw lived out there for a while during the winter and taught flying, and I'm guessing there's a possibility that he taught Clark Gable to fly in the 30s. So when he came back in 47, and there's that famous shot of the start of the race with Clark Gable sitting in the grandstands, almost in the foreground, I rather think that maybe it was Wilbur Shaw that was that was the link. But anyway, so he's coming in to make the film To Please a Lady, and Tony Holman, being the perfect host, says we need to get him something decent to drive around, and they knew that he'd just taken delivery of a Jaguar XK120 in Los Angeles. So they said, let's see if we can find him one. So the story is that Wilbur Shaw, they found one in Chicago, Wilbur Shaw went up and then drove it back. And that's in the Speedway's collection, and it's been used in commercials and so on and so forth. And that was Clark Gable's drive-around car for the month of May in 1950. Now, back up to the wheel gear scene. He comes into the garage, and as he walks through this garage over to wheel gear, there is a lighter-colored Jaguar XK120 sitting there. My guess is that that was his personal car, and that they shot it in Culver City on the lot, and I bet he probably drove it to the studio that day. That's a theory. All right, now, a thing to watch for is that there is this scene where the photo, the panoramic photo, is done, breaks up, everybody's walking back to their cars, and Clark Gable's walking back towards his car, and then Barbara Stanwyck calls to him over the fence, and she, they were sort of enemies for a little bit. She's a journalist, and now they're becoming romantically involved, and he comes over to the fence, and they have this little scene where they're talking to each other for a few moments, and she's basically saying, oh, be careful, and it's dangerous, and look after yourself, kind of a thing. And if you look in the background, everybody's walking back up to their cars. Now, it's not a back projection shot. They're actually filming that, and I'm thinking that they, and for those that are interested in, filmmaking, you do dozens and dozens of takes and probably end up using the first one. They had one opportunity to get that right, because if they tried to say, all right, let's do another take, all the people would have finished walking past them. So I fascinated when I watched that. All right, the final thing to watch for, and then I thought, well, we've done three questions tonight, I think. All right, so
yeah, but we're not on the air.
We're not even on the air. Well, like, that doesn't matter.
We're on the internet. We're running our own program.
All right, great. So anyway, there's this late in the race, there's an accident involving the Clark Gable character, Mike Brannan, and he's taken to the hospital. And Barbara Stanwyck has to run through the infield, and you see the ambulance arriving at the hospital, and they unload the stretcher, and she just arrives, and there's prior to the yellow shirts, they had the safety patrol that wore woolen shirts and a tie and a pith helmet. And so this guard says, something like, lady, you can't go in there, or something like that. And holds her back. It's Cliff Brugere, who is a driver who had just retired that May. And his connection and how he was able to get the part was that the film was directed by Clarence Brown, who directed Garbo twice. So, it was a pretty neat outfit that made the film. And that Cliff Brugere had been a Hollywood stuntman in something like 1,000 films, and he knew Clarence Brown. So anyway, when you get a chance to watch that film, when she's trying to get in the hospital and the guard that stops her from going in, that's Cliff Brugere.
Okay. Thank you, John. More questions coming up on 1070 The Fan, and really more likely, 1070thefan.com.
Donald Davidson, celebrating 40 years as the host of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Brought to you by the Indiana Union Construction Industry. Skilled on principle, union by choice. On 1070, The Fan.
Well, there's some severe weather in the Indianapolis area. I believe Marion County is under a tornado warning, so we are internet only. Tell your friends in the Indianapolis area they can find the show. We did it. It'll be on the podcast at 1070thefan.com. up after 9 o'clock tonight Eastern time. We'll sneak in a few more telephone calls for our internet and podcast listeners tonight. Jerry in Milwaukee is next with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Donald and Kevin. Thank you very much for taking my call tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
One of the big storylines this year, as you guys are aware, are the one-off teams and drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, Donald, throughout the history of the Indy 500, excluding Formula One, NASCAR, and noted sports car drivers, is there the equivalent of one-offs who have either won or had top finishes? Because I'm looking at the list of, you know, certainly the last 50 years, and it seems like most of those drivers were regulars on the IndyCar series. And I was just wondering if there's any surprise winner, you know, like Bruno Junqueira, mm-hmm. you know, wouldn't necessarily be a surprise winner, but he's a one-off driver this year. He could have won. I'm just wondering if there's any instances of that. Probably, there were probably more instances of that early on in the history, but I was just wondering if there was, you mentioned Dwayne Carter being director of competition in the early 50s, and he come out of retirement after 3 years to finish seventh.
Right.
I'm just wondering if there's any interesting anecdotes along that line.
Well, there's tons, but the thing is that it was a very different sport. And when you say one-off, I mean, it used to be that a driver would drive for a team, and pretty much a lot of them were renewable on a race-by-race basis, so people were chopping around and changing all the time. Sam Hanks won in 1957 and ran. That was the last race he drove. Jimmy Bryan in 1958 only ran one championship race, and that was George Salley's car, the little Ballon Sidewinder. And after Hanks retired, because he wasn't running dirt anymore, he only ran Indianapolis in 56, and then in 50 at plush stock cars in 57, same thing, when he won Indianapolis, and then he retired. So Bryan had been talking to George Salley for a while, and he said, you know, when the old man quits, I'd like to drive for you. So when the opportunity came up, he said, you know, Jimmy, he said, we don't have a dirt car. We only run the 500. So Bryan said, well, I've been thinking of cutting back anyway. So he won the 558. That's the only championship race he drove. Another one, too, somebody we were talking about the fact that Graham Hill and in 66 and Clark in 65, but that was Formula One related, so you wanted to not include that, so that's fine. But if you go back to the late 40s, the Blue Crown Specials, the front drive Blue Crown Specials with Lou Moore, they only ran the Indianapolis 500. So Maury Rose in 46 might have run a couple more races, but he was pretty much down to one only. And certainly in 47, 48, 49, 50, and 51, he only drove Indianapolis. So I've got this theory that the last five races that Maury Rose drove was the Indianapolis 500.
Wow.
So, you know, again, and there used to be, and this is not necessarily victories, but even in the 60s into the early 70s, you had the drivers like Bob Veith and Eddie Johnson you know, people like that would come back, and the 500 was the only thing they would run. Johnny Boyd towards the end.
Al Unser in 87, been said he won in a one-off.
Yes.
But he did other races later that year. Was that the first race he did?
Yes, because he was, you know, on Gaius crashed, and then Al was, you know, off of the team, and then he came back onto the team because of the Ongais accident. And then after he won the race, then he did run some more. I think, but not the whole season. I think he ran Michigan
other races.
Yeah.
It's coming up because this year we have legitimate possibilities. Dan Weldon, Buddy Rice, Townsend Bell are three to name that have very quick cars. So Graham Hill, is that the last person to win the 500, in which that's the only Indy car race they did for that season?
Yes.
Okay.
And then he went back to Formula One.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you for the call tonight. Thanks to everyone for listening. I will see everyone at the Kara Fashion Show tomorrow.
Boy, you're doing everything this year.
I'm bringing a ringer. I'm bringing my little girl, Savannah. She will enjoy going down the runway. She loves the little Barbie model place at the Children's Museum. So she'll steal the show tomorrow. So we're looking forward to that. Trackside tomorrow night at 7. Donald and I will be back tomorrow night at 8. Email-only show tomorrow night. I wish I could say email your questions, we'll get them on, but you'll be 187th in line if you're the next one to email in. So I don't know. Maybe we're just going to give out Donald's home phone number, and you can call him coming up in the month of June. Thanks to Matt Hicks. Again, tell people they can find tonight's show on the podcast. We did one. It was preempted because of severe weather. Stay tuned to 1070 The Fan, and if you're listening online or on 93 WIBC. Thank you so much for joining us. And more weather coverage up next, and then eventually ESPN Radio.
Well, I'm going to stay, and I'll play Mark Monteith's show from Sunday.
That's right.
He visited one-on-one with the super fan. I think his name was Richard Bennett. Is that right?
Yes. Every race since 1939, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that'll be streaming on 1070thefan.com, and hopefully the weather clears soon, and we'll get back on the radio.
It's too bad Richard Bennett didn't go to the 1911 500, and then he could tell us what happened.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you tomorrow night here on 1070 The Fan.